Mr. Greer. Morning, sir.
Morning. And may it please the court. Matt Greer on behalf of the Commission for Lawyer Discipline. The district court erred when it dismissed this lawyer discipline case pursuant to the Texas Citizens Participation Act, and the commission asked that this court reverse and remand this case for trial. Specifically, we're asking this court to hold that the TCPA does not supply a defense in lawyer discipline cases, and as well that, or in the alternative, that the commission did establish a prima facie case against Mr. Rosales here.
Is the TCPA technically a defense?
I think it is raised as a defensive motion, so I think we would ask the court to hold that it does not, it just simply doesn't apply in lawyer discipline cases. I hope that brings clarity to the point.
So I'm just trying to determine whether it's a procedural mechanism for potential early dismissal and putting to proof at an earlier stage, or whether it's technically a defense, as you keep using that word.
I think maybe defense is an inarticulate word, that it's inapplicable, that is not a motion that can be brought in a lawyer discipline case. It procedurally cannot be brought. That is what we are asking the court to hold, that it does not apply. And I would submit that the answers are going to have a lasting impact beyond this case in terms of whether the TCPA is going to reshape the lawyer discipline process and whether our disciplinary rules will or will not permit the type of conduct that Mr. Rosales has engaged in here. And with that, I'd like to first address the applicability issue. And I'd like to start actually by I'm cognizant of the pending petition for review from this court's opinion in Sullivan. So there's much and more that we'd like to say about Sullivan, but what I'd really like to highlight first are some reasons why this court can hold the TCPA doesn't apply that are outside of Sullivan. And the first such reason is the exception section contained in section 27.010A. And that section of the TCPA states that the TCPA doesn't apply to an enforcement action that is brought in the name of this state or a political subdivision of this state, and then it says by the attorney general, a district attorney, a criminal district attorney, or a county attorney. So there's two questions that arise there. What is an enforcement action? And then is that list of entities at the end of that statute exclusive? Is it meant to exclude all other not named entities?
I wish Justice Pemberton was here and he could give us that Latin phrase. I try not to pronounce Latin without Bob, but espresso unitas.
I've practiced it all this week, Judge. I'm all ready for it.
Negative implication in English, I guess, is what we're talking about there.
Exactly. In terms of that issue, in terms of the listing of entities, and the Latin phrase, expressio unius e exclusio alterius.
Thank you.
I've practiced it. That the express mention of one is the exclusion of other. What that doctrine tells us is that we need to be able to look and discern, is there some basis by which the legislature considered the unnamed possibility and meant to say no to it? In this case, that would mean, is there some basis to believe that the legislature was trying to parse the TCPA and hold that it's entirely applicable if the litigators are employed in-house in a state agency, but it doesn't apply if the litigators are employed by the attorney general's office or a district attorney's office? And I cannot there's no indication in the legislative record that is actually a line the legislature was seeking to draw. And I cannot fathom a reason why that would be a line with which the TCPA would completely apply or not apply. Really, it would come down to who employs the litigators at that point. And I think that does take us also into the area of an absurd result, a result that could not have been intended by the legislature.
Now, is that cut based upon who's representing the party bringing the enforcement action? You say who employs the litigators,
right?
But isn't it the actual who's bringing the enforcement action, regardless of the lawyers?
Well, it's in the name of the state agency, and then the law says brought by.
Okay.
So it would really be, so oftentimes the attorney general's office or the district, even a district or county attorney's office can be representing or acting in the name of a state agency. So it really would turn on, does the signature block under their name say attorney general, or are they employed in-house in the state agency? And there are a number of agencies, there are different formulations about how those duties are divided. But the notion that the legislature was intending to parse that line as though the TCPA should completely apply in one text and not completely apply it and completely not apply in the other context, I just don't see any basis in the legislative record to conclude that. The other ground and the other argument that's raised by this section is whether or not this is an enforcement action. And I think the Supreme Court has given us our answer in Best versus Harper when it defined an enforcement action as a governmental attempt to enforce a substantive prohibition against unlawful conduct. And that is what the lawyer decision process is about. This court, the Supreme Court, have universally held the disciplinary rules in Texas are to be treated as statutes, and that's what they are. They are legal mandates on lawyers who practice in Texas. The commission is an entity of the state bar, which is a state agency. We are charged with enforcing those rules. And so in every sense, this is an enforcement action.
I guess the appellees seemed to argue that there needed to be some criminal charge at the end of the rainbow on that.
I would respectfully disagree, and I think my colleagues on the other side are reading far more into the Supreme Court's holding in Best than what's actually there. So even the language that the Supreme Court used in Best specifically contemplated this law applying in a civil context as well. It really says unlawful conduct, and there's a host of areas where conduct is unlawful but isn't necessarily criminal. In fact, the Supreme Court specifically talked about how the TCPA is not intended to impede the criminal or civil proceedings that law enforcement or other agencies initiate. So I don't think there's anything within the Supreme Court's opinion that really cabins it to criminal or criminal conduct. I think also within the law itself, I think we would see a phrase not like enforcement action, we would see a phrase like criminal action or a criminal proceeding or conduct that is unlawful under the penal code. So I think my colleagues are reading far more into that phrase than is actually there. And this is an enforcement action.
Does the CFLD ever allege conduct that is unlawful?
Unlawful in that it is also a crime?
Yes.
I believe in the area of barratry that would cross over, there can also be in the specifics of any factual scenario that has arisen in a case, something where something is also perhaps theft or fraud. I don't think that's particularly common. But the rules themselves are legal mandates. They are imposed on those who practice law. And there are legal consequences under those rules when they're violated. The jurisdiction for that flows from the Supreme Court's inherent authority to regulate the legal profession. So in some cases, there is a bleed over into an area of criminal law, but in not every case. But I don't think that distinction would matter here based on the text of the law.
Thank you.
The other ground by which this court could hold the law doesn't apply that's really outside of Sullivan has to do with the statutory conflicts. And there are two that I'd like to highlight. First, the first one has to do with timing. So under Rule 3.07 of the Texas Rules of Disciplinary Procedure, disciplinary cases are to be set within 180 days absent good cause. And under Rule 3.16, the rules really only contemplate appeals from final judgments. And I know my colleagues on the other side say, well, this is just, you know, an extra hurdle that's there along the way. It doesn't create some new big issue. It just means that, hey, there's just one extra thing you have an extra hurdle to clear. And I would respectfully disagree with that because the way that this works in practice fundamentally upends the pretrial process. That's because under the current setting, between the triangular relationship between the court, the respondent, and the commission, at least two of those people have to agree to have a case that goes beyond 180 days. The court is still in control of the docket, and the court decides whether there's good cause to extend it beyond 180 days. With the TCPA, a respondent attorney is able to unilaterally grind their disciplinary case to a halt by simply filing the motion. It stays the case. There's an automatic stay under Chapter 51. The case can't go to trial while we go through the interlocutory appeal process. In that scenario, the attorney can, regardless of how strong the commission's case might be, gets to unilaterally decide to stop that case in its tracks. And I think that's an attractive option, particularly in cases where the misconduct is clear, even if in cases where the TCPA motion may carry little or no merit. Just by filing it, the attorney can put off discipline and continue practicing for up to 2 years while we work through, even on an accelerated basis, work through the interlocutory appeal process.
Aren't there a number of cases that we've seen over the past 5 or 6 years where the TCPA ends up having the effect of stopping the case in its tracks, as you say, and you know, sending it up so that we get to have the joy of handling these interlocutory appeals? And that's not unique to your situation.
What is unique to this situation, though, is the Supreme Court has mandated or intends that these cases be heard within 180 days. And that isn't that is unique and unlike other civil contexts. And that provision really is for the protection of the public and the profession itself. If there is a lawyer who is committing misconduct, it is within it's in the public's interest and the profession's interest to have that addressed in a timely manner, rather than allowing the attorney to unilaterally stop the case, have it continue for 2 years before we even get discovery in the case. So that really does fundamentally change the pretrial process, and that is a statutory conflict between how the current system operates.
Counsel, if we hold that the TCPA applies to lawyer disciplinary proceedings, what effect do you believe that will have on the whole disciplinary process in Texas?
I think that's one of them that especially, I think we'll first off see respondents electing district court on a far higher rate than we currently see. There would be little downside to doing so, especially if you can just by filing this motion get to put off discipline for 2 years. The other fundamental conflict that we have here has to do with immunity. So under section, it's currently codified in rule 17.09, it was 15.09 in the previous version of the rules. The commission and the chief disciplinary counsel's office are conferred absolute and unqualified immunity. It's akin to prosecutorial immunity. And this, if you layer the TCPA on top of that and hold that it abrogates that immunity, despite the TCPA's expressed intent not to abrogate any such immunities, then the commission is now financially liable any time that it loses a pretrial motion. And that would seriously affect whether, when, and how we proceed in disciplinary cases. Prosecutorial immunity exists to allow those types of entities, like the commission or like a prosecutor's office, to carry out their duties without that fear.
How does the Supreme Court's hold in Best versus Harper affect that, though? I mean, don't they essentially say that that is the end result in these TCPA cases, is that state agencies can be on the hook for attorney's fees?
The Supreme Court in Best was dealing with sovereign immunity. That is a creature of common law. The Supreme Court can simply decide to amend or alter its scope, or at least it did so in Best. This is statutory. This is in Rule 17.09. And I would also add that these rules were actually amended in 2018. So if the Supreme Court was intending to also limit that immunity in some way, the issues with the TCPA were well out there at that time. Yet the immunity was recodified in 17.09, and it was identical to the previous version. It is absolute and it's unqualified.
Did the Supreme Court modify sovereign immunity, or did they just interpret what they felt the bounds of it were?
I think
in Best.
I'm struggling to know the difference of modification or defining the bounds. Whatever the case may be, I think the Supreme Court held that sovereign immunity from suit, which was the specific issue they were addressing, did not apply in the TCPA context. And the Supreme Court has, since it's a creature of common law, it has that ability to make that determination. This is statutory, its source is different. The other thing that I also have to add, though, is that it was the Supreme Court in Best was specifically addressing sovereign immunity from suit because it had not been raised in the sovereign immunity from liability had not been raised in the court below. We did. I'd also just like to briefly address this court's opinion in Sullivan. And I know my colleagues will point out the procedural differences between this case and Sullivan. But I think what's most important about this court's opinion in Sullivan has to do with how the court viewed the TCPA, not narrowly construing its strict terms, but looking at it with a broader view of the larger statutory context in which it appears. Just like with the ethics enforcement process, the lawyer discipline process has its own set of procedures. To layer the TCPA on top of that, just as was the case in Sullivan, would create an end run around those procedures. I'd like to briefly touch on the merits of this case. And at the outset, I'd first like to note the proper legal standard. And I don't think this was intentional, but my colleagues on the other side offered a completely incorrect statement of the law to the district court here. They told the district court that the prima facie case under the TCPA has to be proved by direct evidence, that it cannot be evidence from which an inference can be drawn. That is the opposite of what the Supreme Court held in N. Ray Lipsky. And so at the outset, I think we have to approach the evidentiary questions or the prima facie case questions with the proper standard in mind. And that's what we have here. The face of these letters and the material cited within our response and attached to our response show that there are rule violations here, that there is a use of a trade name under Rule 7.01. I've not been able to identify any distinguishing factor between Mr. Rosales's, and I don't think my colleagues have either, between Mr. Rosales's law practice and this Center for Veterans Access. There's also a host of threats and statements made in the letter that about the applicability of the ADA to websites that we see from the law are simply not accurate. And they go beyond the mere sort of puffery and posturing that one would expect in a demand letter. The context is important here. They're sent to these medical clinics. They say make all these bold claims about how the TCPA applies. They threaten all these horrible consequences. DHHS is going to come strip your Medicare funding, and there's going to be lawsuits. But it can all go away with this $2,000 payment. It's to create this I realize my time has expired, but it's to create this Hobson's choice. You pay Mr. Rosales, or you pay a lawyer much more to fight that conduct.
Can I ask one question while you're on this topic? So from the commission's perspective, and to clear the hurdle of the prima facie case, do you have to prove elements as to multiple of those claims, all of those claims, just one of those claims? What was the burden you were trying to meet at the trial court, and have you met that?
I think the burden is to prove the elements on each of those claims. I think for the court to reverse and remand, I think it would only technically have to find that there was at least one, although I would say that, as laid out in the briefing, the elements of each one of those rule violations is met by the face of the letters, by the materials that we've also attached and cited within our motion, and also the inferences that can be drawn from those materials. I think that's really the key point here, is that arguing to the district court it has to be only direct evidence is a misstatement of the law. These materials do allow a reasonable inference to be drawn that these misrepresentations were conscious, that they were intended to be coercive, that they were intended to be harassing and to pressuring these entities into quick financial settlements. So that's, and I can speak more about that on rebuttal unless the court has any other specific questions.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. Mr. Rudinger, good morning. No relation to Rudy, I take it.
No, Your Honor. Unfortunately, I cannot claim that namesake. Well, I'll be honest. I've tried it a couple times. It just doesn't pay off.
If he had your size, he probably wouldn't have made a movie.
No, they don't believe that I'm the underdog defensive lineman when the time comes. May it please the court. I will address counsel's arguments kind of in the order that he took them, because our position, as you'll see in our briefing, is that the TCPA does apply, and it can be applied in lawyer discipline, and to do what it's intended to do, to prevent lawsuits that may not have a basis in law. That's basically the intent of the TCPA, and that's what we filed our motion for, and that's what, as Judge Wallace noted in the trial court, the ending result was.
Do you believe that lawyers have a First Amendment right to violate the disciplinary rules of Texas?
Justice Kelly, I don't think there's a First Amendment right at issue here. The courts and the cases have been pretty clear that the First Amendment's not embedded in the TCPA. I know there's case law regarding what First Amendment rights a lawyer has when he's channeling and calling on his constitutional rights. However, here we have the statutory rights under the TCPA, which, as the Supreme Court has said and as other opinions have noted, there's no real constitutional boundary in the right to petition, right to free speech, and right of association, names that conjure up constitutional protections, but in the lay of the statute and as we've interpreted, do not have the bounds that are applied from the Constitution. So there's not a real First Amendment right issue here. What we have here is a TCPA issue and how it's being applied. And our position is that this isn't going to blow up the discipline system. This isn't going to eviscerate the cases that we already have and the way it works. What we have now is an opportunity to put the Commission for Lawyer Discipline in cases that frankly trigger the TCPA. There still has to be a communication based on, related to, or in response to one of those three statutory rights. As long as that's satisfied, then they have the opportunity to present their prima facie case.
How do you get past his premonition that, you know, this is going to not be able to square with 180-day dictate from the Supreme Court, because in most or all cases you're going to end up with this procedural mechanism put in place?
Certainly. Chief Justice Rose, I think what you run into here is a law that, as the Houston Court in the Neely opinion from 2009 has noted, this is not a jurisdictional, this is not a mandatory rule, this is more a discretionary to try to speed up those processes when they're trial court. But this isn't a mandate by the Supreme Court that these be tried in 180 days. The Neely Court found that wasn't a jurisdictional ground, that it was just because it was tried outside 180 days didn't make it not lawyer discipline. So it doesn't mean that the interlocutory appeal then does away with that. You can still read those in harmony. We get an interlocutory appeal on an expedited basis. But once it comes back, it's not the 180-day rule has been eviscerated. It's just that you have to now operate within an interlocutory appeal. And as counsel mentioned, you have rights to a final appeal like you would in any civil nature. And as Chief Justice Rose noted, there is interlocutory appeals in all these civil cases. And the rules say that a disciplinary action in the district court is treated civil by nature. So it's treated as a civil lawsuit, which would have interlocutory appeals, as well as a final appeal on final judgment. You get both of those opportunities. So these two can be read in harmony, whereas in the Sullivan opinion, that was really the outliers. You had a different structure where you'd gone through an administrative hearing and so on, and it was on an appeal to the district court, and an absurd result that you would have reached there. Mr. Sullivan was asking that the district court dismiss the claims against him that had been brought by the commission and had already been proven against him. He's asking basically to dismiss his own appeal.
Do you have to distinguish or overcome Sullivan to win your argument on that front?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think what we have is a different case from Sullivan because we have a drastically different factual scenario here in that we haven't had a predetermination at administrative hearing. We aren't on an appellate level. We aren't trying to dismiss claims against us on appeal. I don't know what would have happened if he'd brought that in the SOA proceeding. But what we have here is a lawsuit that was filed and an opportunity to present it. But we also have, I think, a distinguishing characteristic from Sullivan in that you can read the two together, that you can harmonize the TCPA with the rules of disciplinary procedure, and that they can lay side by side with each other and fit together. And as the court in Sullivan noted, if you have an older statute that's not repealed, you try to harmonize them if at all possible. And here, I think, based in, as you'll see in our briefing, and as I just described here, you can harmonize the TCPA with the rules of disciplinary procedure. They just have to go through and follow those rules. As far as the exemption that counsel talked about in the enforcement action, I believe that we have the two issues here regarding the list and then regarding what actually entails an enforcement action. I'll kind of address those in different order. I'll address the enforcement action first. What the best court said in the enforcement action and the way they looked at it was that there was it against the law that the actions that he had sued in to get the hospital administrator removed. In that case, there were claims of incompetency and that there were allegations that he'd been drinking while he was serving in the hospital board, and they said, you know, being the town drunk is not make you the best hospital administrator, but it's not against the law. The best court really analyzed that as far as criminal by nature. We understand that there are claims that it's criminal or civil and that an enforcement action might venture into civil. But that brings us back to the second part, which is the list of the attorneys that are in there. And it says you have the attorney general, district attorney, criminal district attorney, or a county attorney. The list is there. And as we've analyzed and as the Supreme Court has said in Coleman and as this court said in Elite Auto Body, the words of the statute mean something. We can't add words there to make it say what we should. The way we analyze the text is we look at the language. If it's unambiguous, we apply the words that are there. If the words are not there, we have to assume they were intended not to be there. So in this case, there's a list of four attorneys that can bring this action. And those, the attorney general, district criminal attorney, district attorney, and county attorney are the one. And frankly, in Best, that's what triggered the enforcement action. Because in that one, the state had stepped in and the Somerville County attorney was bringing the cause of action. It wasn't Mr. Best anymore. It was the state on that side. So you had a state county attorney bringing what they deemed an enforcement action, and that's why it was going to be exempted, and they sent it back to the trial court for consideration in that underlying lawsuit. So you still have to hit both of those. You can't have an enforcement action. You can't have it brought by a different attorney. You have to have both. So even if the court considers that civil penalties or that the rules of disciplinary conduct are penalties that would be considered an enforcement action, you still have to get to that next hurdle.
I mean, pretty commonly aren't civil penalty type cases considered enforcement actions?
And Your Honor, quite candidly, I would say so. That I think if you look at the Best, that they articulated as to the criminal in nature, but they are also looking at official misconduct, and they talk about violations of the Open Meetings Act. I honestly am not sure if there's a penal violation to violations of the Open Meetings Act or if that's criminal by nature. I would think that would be harsh. But I think that either way, what you have is an enforcement action that must be brought by one of those four classes of attorneys. And in the Best case, you had the Somerville County attorney that was sitting on the other side, making that an enforcement action that then the trial court needed to to review and determine if the TCPA was applicable in that instance. The other issue that counsel brought up was the sovereign immunity, and I believe that the best court also addressed that in the in their opinion, and the court hit on that already, is that the Supreme Court was looking at not only the factors for sovereign immunity, but why sovereign immunity should be applicable in that instance. And they went through a bunch of different cases, the Kinnear case and Riata and Manchuk, I believe, and they looked at how they had done it in those instances and why they'd applied sovereign immunity and why they hadn't. And really what it ultimately came down to was that you have a statute that's designed to protect somebody's rights to petition, somebody's rights to free speech, somebody's rights to association. And what you want to be able to do is protect those rights and file these motions. If it's found that someone has tread on those, and as the court said in Best, especially the government or a state actor, they should be responsible for paying the people for the costs of their fees. And that's what the Best court ruled, and that's why they waived immunity.
Did they find a specific waiver in Best from some source?
Your Honor, they abrogated sovereign immunity in Best. They analyzed what was, and abrogations, a judicial construct, as they can determine where immunity applies, and looking at where they'd done it in Kinnear and hadn't done it in Manchuk, they kind of realized that that's, you have to look at the underlying circumstances and determine if sovereign immunity would be fair in those situations. And in that situation, they found that the TCPA, based primarily on its purpose and what it's designed to do, would be beneficial, and it would be detrimental to the state to be trying to tread on someone's rights in that instance, and that made it so they should be able to pay for the fees on that.
Do you believe the legislature ever intended TCPA to cover lawyer disciplinary actions?
Justice Kelly, I'm not sure. I know, as this court noted in Cavan, we really can't guess at to what the legislature meant. We have to use the words that are in front of us. I believe the quote from that opinion was, they opted for a hand grenade and not a rifle shot. And if that's what they intended to do, and perhaps because of the overarching rights that are protected, they wanted to have a widespread statute that covered wide swaths of what conduct would be covered. And frankly, in the Coleman opinion that came out of the Supreme Court, I think that's what really kind of dictated this going into areas that don't think people thought that the TCPA would necessarily reach. But we have to apply the language of the statute. And as the court said in there, you look at it, if the text says that, and if it's unambiguous, we must apply the words of the statute. And that's what we have here, is there's been no dispute that the claims from the Commission for Lawyer Discipline were based on communications by Mr. Rosales. They were demand letters that were sent out. Those are communications under the statute. So once we trigger the TCPA, we need to be able to then turn over to the Commission for Lawyer Discipline, and they have the opportunity through clear and specific evidence to establish their prima facie case, which in this instance we allege that they did not. There was one demand letter that was attached to their motion, one demand letter attached to their petition. There was no affidavits. There was no other support. And as the TCPA requires, it's determined on affidavits and pleadings.
Is there any evidentiary dispute as to the validity of those letters? I mean, you all concede that he sent those letters.
Correct, Your Honor. There were eight cases that were before the court in that, eight instances of the demand letters. The demand letter that was attached was similar to demand letters that was sent to all eight of those. But frankly, Your Honor, what we have is demand letters that are similar, that are sent out in cases all the time. You have a pre-suit demand letter. You have rhetoric in that demand letter. And rhetoric that, as the affidavit of our client showed, he believes that the applicability of the ADA to the websites is essential, not only essential to him as a disabled American, a disabled veteran, but to other disabled Americans that are out there that are trying to access these services.
Wasn't there some admission on his part that the law on whether the ADA applied was unclear?
Your Honor, that is correct. There, and we don't know, because there hasn't been an adjudication on it. However, in reading the cases and in reading federal law, as well as the releases from the DOJ and other government agencies, there's an argument that can be made that it does apply.
Well, do the letters state that there's an argument to be made, or that it's unclear, or don't they seem to assert that it's, at least according to the letter, a clear violation?
Well, Chief Justice Roth, I think what you see there is our position and my client's position that it is a violation, because those rules do apply. We believe that if it was adjudicated in front of a court, that the courts would determine that those rules apply. And that's his position. And there's a reasonable belief there on the part of our client allows him to make those statements that, you know, there's a certain leeway that you get as a litigator in sending pre-suit demand letters there, and that's what we feel this is. It's a reasonable belief on our client's behalf that these were applicable and that these were necessary for these companies and their websites to comply.
But before we move off on the subject, you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that these letters themselves are not enough to establish a prima facie case. In your opinion, what additional information or evidence would have to be before the court to establish a prima facie case in this situation?
Certainly, Your Honor. I'm not sure what evidence it would take to establish these, but what we know is that the TCPA requires clear and specific evidence for a prima facie case for each essential element of a claim. You asked a question earlier about what needs to be established to establish all these violations of rules, and frankly, the Commission for Lawyer Discipline needs to go through and show on each individual rule how each essential element is met through the evidence that's before the court, either through affidavit testimony or either through the evidence that's presented to it. And as we go through these...
Or pleadings, correct?
Or the pleadings, correct, Your Honor. among those, they need to have enough in there to sustain each essential element of each essential claim. And if you look at the briefing and as you go through the various allegations that they have against our client, you'll notice that there are elements that are missed. For instance, Rule 301, a lawyer shall not bring or defend a proceeding or assert a controversial issue therein unless the lawyer reasonably believes there is a basis for doing so that is not frivolous. We never had a proceeding that was brought. We never filed a lawsuit. We never took a position in a lawsuit. Therefore, they didn't establish the element that they should not bring or defend a proceeding or assert or controvert an issue therein, unless the lawyer reasonably believes there is a basis for doing so that is not frivolous. The affidavit, the only affidavit testimony that was before the court was from our client describing and explaining why he thought these rules were applicable and where his belief came from in those issues. There's just not enough evidence in there to be able to support a finding of violations of these rules. And that's why Judge Wallace, on two different occasions, during an oral argument, asked the Commission for Lawyer Discipline, their lawyers, where's the evidence on the record? Show me the evidence. What evidence supports these claims? And both times they were unable to provide any evidence because all they have is the one demand letter before the court and the pleadings.
What about your client's use of the Center for Veterans Access as a trade name?
Justice Kelly, I think what we run into there is and you look at the affidavit of my client, someone that was trying to set up a legal aid clinic for Veterans Access. He had, being a disabled veteran himself, he saw a need and he thought there was an opportunity there for him to be able to help other veterans. He established the clinic, had some pushback from those in the industry, those that were working on the case, and decided he didn't want to move forward with it. He dissolved it, didn't have anything any further with it at that point in time. So they have a claim that he's violating that. It's nothing more than anyone would have done in a legal aid clinic in that situation, or him just trying to help somebody out. This is the no good deed goes unpunished rule where he's trying to help out, in this case, his brother, and trying to get help and get these websites access and do stuff for veterans that are disabled and just struggle in that area.
And would you agree that the Veterans Legal Aid Clinic that you just mentioned had the same address and phone number as his law office?
Quite candidly, he operated it from his office because he hadn't had an opportunity to really separate. He had an idea, had an opportunity, started it. It didn't pan out, and he immediately ceased doing business as it. He signed any petitions that he was going to file. None of the petitions that were attached to the demand letter and the petition that was attached to this demand letter was not from the Center of Veterans Access. It was from Omar Rosales, from the Rosales Law Firm.
Did the demand letter have the Veterans Access?
I believe it did. I believe it came from the Center of Veterans Access. And again, Your Honor, this was at the opportunity while he was trying to help out other disabled veterans and trying to further that cause. There was nothing untoward about it. He had an opportunity that frankly didn't pan out.
Well, I guess that's something you don't really have to prove today, right? I mean, that's something that if the substantive aspect of this were to go forward,
correct,
would be on
Your
the
Honor.
Table. And you seem to be putting them to a burden of proof beyond the prima facie case.
Well, Your Honor, what we also have under the TCPA, and I do apologize for kind of getting into the nuts and bolts of the claims, is even if they're able to establish a prima facie case, if us as movement are able to establish by preponderance any defense to the claims, the case is also dismissed. So there's kind of a, it's an early on, you have to show us your hand and we get to show you our hand and see who wins. So that is why we kind of get into the nuts and bolts of the arguments as to the claims themselves, because not only do we have to put them to the task of showing their prima facie case through clear and specific evidence, we also have the opportunity then to present our own evidence to establish by a preponderance a defense to those claims. Briefly, Your Honor, I do want to address one issue that came up regarding the discovery and a request for additional discovery. We feel that the trial court was correct in not awarding additional discovery after the hearing, primarily on the fact that it gives the Commission for Lawyer Discipline two bites at the same apple. They have an opportunity to show up, present their case. If the court determines, or they get the feeling that the court's going to determine that their case should be dismissed, they can request additional discovery, get information, show back up, and find out where the holes in their case are and try to fill them before a ruling is made. In this instance, we don't believe that the statute permits that. The statute wouldn't allow that. They have to rule within 30 days from the hearing. And just the time frame to propound discovery, answer discovery, and have the court consider the discovery in a 30-day window is very difficult, if near impossible, at that point in time.
What is the discovery, then, that the TCPA contemplates?
The TCPA contemplates that they can request discovery in advance of the hearing, is our position, and it gives them, once discovery is requested, if the court orders this specific discovery as to the claims, the hearing can move out to 180 days as opposed to the 60-day timeline that's in the statute, giving the parties time to propound the discovery, answer the discovery, handle any discovery disputes, and respond to the motion accordingly. So as far as after the hearing, there's a 30-day timeline that's already taken as soon as the hearing stops and starts. I have nothing further unless there's
Thank
any questions.
Mr. Rudinger. Mr. Greer, we've got 5 minutes reserved for your rebuttal.
Thank you.
In terms of this argument that the rules can be read in harmony, I would point the court to some additional language in Rule 3.07. No motion for continuance, resetting, or agreed pass may be granted unless required by the interests of justice. I would also point to Rule 3.08, which says, except as varied by these rules, the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure apply. So in the rules itself from the Supreme Court, we see that the specifics are to control over the general procedural rules. And it is a conflict because under Rule 3.07, you know, no motion for a continuance unless required by the interests of justice, that places the district court in charge of the docket. And I agree, that provision in the rule setting isn't a mandatory provision, but all of that means is that the proceeding doesn't become invalid if for some reason it is set after 180 days. It doesn't mean that it gives some external law the ability to allow a respondent to completely decide on his own to stop the case in its tracks simply by filing a motion. In terms of the immunity, again, the immunity in Best that was considered is sovereign immunity. This is statutory. And it is akin to the prosecutorial immunity in that it allows prosecutorial entities to do their job. No entity is infallible. Sometimes these cases come down to honest disagreements about whether conduct is within a rule or whether it's not within a rule. And the notion that a prosecutor's office, or in this case the state bar, is now liable for attorney's fees every single time, even if we have an honest good faith argument and if the judge rules in opposition to that, that places a financial burden to pay the attorney's fees to the other side any time that happens, is an extreme chilling effect on the prosecutorial duty that the commission is instructed to carry out.
Has that ship sailed after Best?
It has not, because this is statutory. It is not sovereign immunity. The Supreme Court in 2018 recodified the rules of disciplinary procedure. This immunity provision is untouched. It is unqualified, and it is absolute immunity. So it is separate and apart from sovereign immunity. In terms of the prima facie case, one of the things that we've heard from my colleague is that there was no evidence. But I think he also agreed that it is also based on the pleadings. I would point the court to some specific statements that are in these demand letters. Statements saying, as you are aware, The Americans with Disabilities Act applies to websites. Mr. Rosales and my colleague just agreed it's an open legal question. In fact, we got our first answer about 3 weeks ago. District Court in Houston, Judge Lake held for the first time 3 weeks ago, the ADA does not apply to websites. Saying this in this sort of presumptive fashion, as you are aware, particularly in the context to a non-lawyer, is more than just the type of puffery that we would see in a demand letter. Also, and more important than that, statements like under federal law, your website must comply with the new requirements of the ADA and the WCAG. On page 322 and page 323 of our response to the district court, we included citations to websites promulgated first by the Department of Justice and also by the group, the private industry group that promulgates these WCAG standards, showing they are not requirements of federal law. Just because and Mr. Rosales' position is predicated on, well, they were cited in some settlement agreement where the government was involved, that's different than somehow representing, particularly to a non-lawyer, that this is now a requirement of the federal law.
So how do you answer the concern that, the commission's position in this case is going to make every plaintiff's lawyer subject to commission action because whatever they've said in a demand letter will be put on the microscope?
I think what we have in this letter rises above that because it's specific and it's also within the context. The context is important as well. Sending these directly to these medical clinics that are not lawyers, making these affirmative representations that are not accurate. And this isn't just saying we believe the law is going to extend into this area or believe you will be held to these accounts. It says the new requirements of the ADA implying that there's been legislative action. That's simply not accurate. There is evidence of that cited in our response in the district court. It was fairly before the district court. And it shows that these statements go beyond that. And I would also point.
So, counsel, is it your position that if there was qualifiers in these letters, akin to what you're talking about, like we believe or it's our position that those letters wouldn't rise to disciplinary action?
And I realize my time is soon to expire, if I may answer. As it pertains to the violations of Rule 8.04A3, which is conduct involving dishonesty, also 8.04A5 and 4.04B1, it's possible, but not necessarily, because there's other elements of the letters that are also dishonest, and also in terms of Rule 3.01, which is the prohibition on bringing frivolous claims. I mean, we have the admission in the briefing in this case that this was Mr. Rosales going out and seeking out websites to find to send to these clinics. Not that he was trying to access care, not that his brother was trying to access care, but that he was going out and trying to find targets. And under Rule 3.01, an action is frivolous if its primary purpose is to harass another person. Again, we're here on a prima facie case, not conclusive proof. There is more than enough here for a jury to determine in this context, with this state of the law, the way this was presented, it was designed to be coercive. It wasn't legitimate advocacy, that it was something much greater than that. For that reason, we would ask this court to reverse, to hold that the TCPA does not apply, or in the alternative, that there is a prima facie case, allow this case to go to trial, allow Mr. Rosales to answer for his actions, and allow the disciplinary system to do its job. If there are no more other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. Thank you, Ms. Rudinger. Case well argued, very interesting case. Case will be submitted and the court will stand in recess. Thank you all.